so much muscle. It's got so much brawn.
Welcome to the Pluralcast. This is episode number 10, Reading Code. As software developers, we spend a lot of time reading not only our own code that we've written previously, but other people's code as well. Anybody who's worked in a brownfield or pre-existing code-based environment understands that feeling that I have to get in there and spend some time understanding the code that someone else wrote. The dailywtf.com, which actually stands for worsethanfailure.com, is a website dedicated really to reading other developers' code. Now, most of the code submitted to the site, most of the stories about it, focus on really, really bad code samples, or at least bad in the eyes of the reader. And there are numerous examples on the dailywtf.com of code that has surprised the reader, followed by all of the discussion and poking fun of that code that people can do in comments on the code that's posted to the site. The Daily WTF has been around for a long time. It's been online since 2004 and has a huge collection of code that developers have found not only unreadable in many cases, but also worthy of shame. Now, why is it that so many developers have a different idea about what should be expressed in code than the people who wrote it? Why is it that we open a code file and are often surprised at what we find there? Today's guest, Alan Stevens, has some very specific ideas about how we can address the problem of code that's essentially unreadable. And Alan has found some really apropos parallels between the world of writing literature and writing software.
Well, reading code is really what we do as developers. I mean, well, you can start out with a blank sheet, but then you're going to go back and reread it. One of the things that I've really gotten into lately from the literature on writing, guidance on writing and writing workshops is how important drafts are. So the first draft is almost inconsequential. It's just a way to get yourself started, to write something down that you can then work into something useful. And I think we so often undervalue that in software development, the idea that we're going to get this first implementation down, and then we're going to read through that and learn, because then we can see out on the screen in the editor what our thoughts were in our head. And now that we can see it more clearly, we can form better thoughts and express those better. So the reading of the code is how I write the code, because I don't ever read code that I can modify without modifying it as I read it. This drives some people crazy, because if I have a build break I have to fix, I check in 150 line change. But it's just, if I'm going to touch this file and I'm going to try to understand it, I'm going to try to extract meaning from the code, then as I'm trying to extract meaning, I'm going to be shaping it to better express the meaning that it has. Whether I wrote it or anyone else, it's not an ego thing. It's not, oh, you know, this developer didn't do things the way I do. It's just every time you read it and you get the understanding in your head, you see it a little more clearly than you did the time before. And so I like to go in and express that in the code while I'm reading it.
So you're not talking just exactly about reading code. You're talking about sort of molding the clay, right? Putting your hands back in and keeping the thing turning.
Yeah, I don't know how to not do that. I mean, I know I can certainly read example code, that kind of thing. But that's very unsatisfying, really. You know, there's no payoff there. Because the payoff to me is gleaning the understanding and then turning that into an even better expression. You know, that's why open source is so very cool, and the whole idea of joint code ownership in the Agile community is the idea that we can all do this, so we gain the benefit, because you and I are not going to see things the same. When I first implement a solution, I will focus on the thing that was the hardest for me to understand, and I will try to express that. and then you will come along and you'll read it, and that thing that was hard to me will hopefully look fairly obvious in my solution, and then you will notice other areas that need better expression. Gosh, who's the guy that wrote that came up with the wiki?
Ward Cunningham?
Ward. Ward Cunningham says, once you've figured out what you're trying to do, then you have to go back and make it look easy. And that's what, so reading code is figuring out what it's trying to do and then going back and making it look easy. And easy can be making it look obvious and also easy to extend, flexible.
So often what I'll do, and let's see if we're talking about the same thing here so that we can get a tangible example. If I'm reading someone else's code, oftentimes what I'll find in there is a conditional that'll say, you know, if variable equals 62, I don't know, something like that.
Right.
It takes me just a moment to understand what it was that they were really checking for there, because there's a logical check that they're making, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that is if the score is at maximum, let's say. And if that's the case, I'll throw in a quick extract method refactoring, you know, is score at maximum. And that, to me, helps me read the code more cleanly next time. And I sprinkle those little things all over the place. Is that the kind of molding
that
you're talking about?
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Because when I was writing that code, 62 was hard-coded in my brain. I knew it meant the maximum, but I had a harder issue I was trying to solve. And so I just typed out 62 and it read obviously to me at the time, right? Because I'm holding all these values in my head while I'm writing the code. You come back cold and you have to stop and sort it out. And once you see the cost to our employers is the time that we spend trying to sort that out. And so once you have made that investment to understand it, you might as well make it absolutely explicit and obvious to the next person that comes along. So yeah, you can do an extract method, or, you know, at the very least, I go through and I just start putting constants all through the code where there's a constant, because the constant reads with a name that says what it is. So I don't need to know 62. I need to know, you know, maximum score or winning score or something like that.
Right. Now, is this the idea from that you've borrowed from literature thinking lately around creating multiple drafts, or is that something different?
I think it's both. I mean, I think it's a practice that I have developed over time. I mean, I've just learned that's how I work best. You know, that may be an idiosyncrasy of me, that I work best I have to write the code when I read the code. I have to manipulate it, make it clearer as I go along, because that's how I'm sure I understand it, right? When I do that extract method and it reads better, I'm like, okay, good. I know what this does now. But the value in the literature, sure, guidance, the guidance on writing, is they talk so much about drafts, and they talk about how the first draft is the hardest to get on the page and you shouldn't have any expectations for it. And this is the real flaw that I identified when I was reading this information, is in our industry, we expect the first draft to be right and good. We expect it to build, we expect to check it into source control, and we expect to release it to the customer. And those are all unreasonable expectations. So what we end up with is a sense of anxiety and fear about creating that initial solution, because it has to be good and it has to be right. And what I've seen by having my fingers in so many code bases is that leads people to simply duplicate what they've done before. I believe very strongly that you cannot be stupid and be a software developer. There's, you know, there's a threshold of intelligence at which you can or cannot develop software. And so if I'm going to assume that this previous developer was intelligent, which they were, then why are they duplicating the solution that they did 10 years ago again today? It's fear, because they don't have the freedom to constantly revise and improve their code. They have to ship the first thing that comes from their keyboard.
I know that you've been drawing some parallels lately between the act of writing for the craft of writing and writing software in the craft of software development. What is it that you've been writing, I should say, in English or not code? What's the stuff that you've been writing that's gotten your head in this space?
Well, I sat around at the end of the last year and pondered what I wanted to do this year, and what would my focus be. I reflected back on all of my journals from years ago at things I wanted to do, and one of the things I wanted to do was write songs. And I've played guitar and sang other people's songs for years, but I've never really written songs, and I didn't even know where to, get a toehold in songwriting. On a wish list, I had this book, Bird by Bird, that Merlin Mann from 43 Folders recommended in one of his blog posts, and so I just added it there. But it's about the craft of writing and life, and I thought, well, I'll give that a listen and see if that gets me started. Unfortunately, it hasn't been very productive as far as songwriting, but it has been really useful as a metaphor for thinking about software development.
And you have some pretty fundamental tenets that you've taken away from there. One of them is be bold. And what does that mean to you?
Well, that idea, that anxiety that I was describing earlier, where a software developer will continue to repeat the known solution they had in the past in disparate situations because they know it works. That, that's fear and that's anxiety, and they don't have the sense of freedom to be bold and try something out. We don't have a lot of guidance in our industry, in our craft, to create things and then pitch them out. I remember listening to Michael Feathers talk about one strategy for dealing with a very large legacy code base. He said, pull the entire source tree and then make all the changes you want to make, rearrange it, do whatever you want to get a feel for what's there and where you want it to go, and then throw that away. Never check it back in. And that struck me as just such a radical idea because we never do that. We never make a sketch before we do our painting. We're expected to do the painting first. And that's nearly impossible. And so that idea of being bold sets you free to find a better solution, but you've got to have some strategies and some practices in place to enable that.
Isn't this the role that architecture spikes play in our world?
That architecture spikes and test-driven development, things like that are very useful in this, but they're not widely accepted. And one reason I got excited about this metaphor of writing is that in talking to people over the last 5 years, I've been speaking out at user groups and conferences and that sort of thing. What I find is if I start using the word spike, or I say test-driven development, or behavior-driven development, or context specification, or agile, or any of these keywords that are meaningful to me, but they're unfamiliar to someone else, that immediately sets my audience apart from me. It somehow puts them on the defensive that I'm saying that the way they're doing things is wrong. And it's subtle, but I don't want to preach to the choir. I don't want to only talk to people that agree with me. I want to help and enable other developers that aren't attracted to Agile or maybe are intimidated by Agile practices. And so this metaphor allows me to discuss these same problems without using these keywords and talking explicitly about these practices. I can talk more about the problem these practices are trying to solve.
And there's some other things too, aren't there? That we one of the things you mentioned was focusing on short assignments. You see that as a, or I guess you've learned that as a technique that, say, a fiction or nonfiction writer would have. We see that in software development all the time, don't we? We break something up into smaller and smaller problems.
Well, right, and we should. The issue is, where do you get started, right? Where do you find the thread that you start to tug on to unravel the whole situation? And obviously, that to me, that is the huge value of test-driven development, because it allows me to say, I'm going to solve this one little bit in isolation. And so often, in existing code bases, doing anything in isolation is this huge, overwhelming challenge. But we can still take that concept of, I have this big chunk of functionality and behavior that I want to implement or modify, and I can break it down smaller and lower my own expectations to get out of my own way. Annie Lamott in Bird by Bird says, you know, she has a 1-inch picture frame, a 1x1-inch picture frame on her desk. She says, I'm only going to write what can fit in this picture frame. So I'm going to write this little scenario. I'm going to take my character out of the car, up the steps, and into the apartment. Done. You know, not this whole, I'm going to define the entire plot for the rest of the novel. And so she says, all I'm going to do is, and, you know, answer that. And then that's where you get started. And those small assignments take you from there. She has a great quote. It's by E.L. Doctorow. He says, writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. And I really like that idea for software development, because if we do this small piece and that small piece and that small piece, we'll end up with some really impressive functionality, but it can be overwhelming at the start.
I'm starting to, as I listen to you, apply some, or try and apply some of what you're saying to work that I've done in the past. Now, I've written articles for various magazines and, of course, blog entries and things like that over the years. And what I know about writing is that my content will turn out better if what I do is just throw everything out that I'm thinking and then massage things around and, most importantly, delete half of what I wrote.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm seeing now that, you know, that has a lot of applicability in my software that I write as well. Have you found that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I create all kinds of things. I was working on a little software problem last week, and I was refactoring one piece to a more extensible pattern. And once I knew at the beginning I had this sense of I want to go to a place where I'm going to return behavior. I'm just going to return lambdas, and that way the code that consumes the lambdas can just execute it and doesn't have to know how I selected which of these calculations I'm using. But I didn't know how I was going to get there, so I just refactored progressively. And then when I got there, I realized I had this whole middle piece that was unnecessary once I reached the ultimate solution, and I had to delete tests and delete classes. But that's a very good thing. That means my code is simpler. There's less code to read. There's less code for the next developer to understand. So, yeah, if we can remove all the junk, then we get down to what's really valuable. The problem is if we don't have that freedom, we end up shipping all of it. And that's where we build up this technical debt, because next time you have to look at this code, you have to understand all of it, the useful part and the not useful part.
You keep bringing up the idea of me as a software developer not having the freedom to move my code in the direction I want it to move. Do you think that is because of constraints of time, pressure to deliver? Or in some cases, might that just be, you know what, I've done this in the past. I know that if I write this code just this way because I've done it, then I've solved my problem.
Well, I think it's all of the above. But we can't, as software developers, we have to live with the business environment we're in. It's neither good nor bad. It's just a fact. So what I'm trying to address is the getting the developer out of his own way. I want the developer to be bold, be free, and be truthful. That's what Brenda Yulin says in her book, If You Want to Write. That's like her mantra, is be bold, be free, and be truthful. And oftentimes that anxiety that I spoke of earlier, that fear of breaking the build, the fear of, of having a manager come down on you when something doesn't work. You know, most software development environments don't have continuous integration. Most software environments don't have tests. And so they're living in a very anxiety-ridden world. You know, most code bases are Jell-O code. I don't remember where I heard this, but I love it. It's the idea that you touch it on one side and it wiggles on the other, you know, and you don't know why.
So the rest of that I've heard is that if you wait for the Jell-O to stop moving, and as soon as it does, you ship it.
Right, exactly. Well, but that's not a bad thing, because the 37 Signals guys say, you know, how do you ship on time and on budget? When you run out of time or money, you ship.
Right.
And there's validity in that if you always have a working code base. So the idea here that I'm trying to present is that if you can free yourself up to try things and to write crap and then go back and you have the opportunity to clean it up later, you're going to end up with something better in the end. But most software developers don't think about their day-to-day work in this manner. They don't. Writers have to think about it this way because they have editors. Most software developers that I've met over the years don't have anybody reading their code until somebody has to fix a bug and then comes and beats them over the head and shoulders and saying, what the hell were you thinking?
That's a good point, that a newspaper article, as an example, is not going to make it into the paper until it's been by a few different sets of eyes.
Right. And, you know, code review, everybody agrees code reviews are a good idea. I've worked in one shop where we did it. And it was great there. It is great. Because if you have a regular culture of code review, then people are less defensive about their code. And there's not this sense of attack and defense. It's more, hey, we want to make this the best product we can. And I noticed something you didn't notice because you were thinking about other issues. And we get a shared brain share of ideas and understanding of the code.
What does it mean to tell the truth? That's one of the fundamentals that you came up with here. And I can't read that one. What does that mean?
Right. That one took me a while to apply to software development. I said, Brenda Uhland says, be bold, be free, be truthful. But truthfulness and honesty comes around again and again in the literature on writing. And one vector you can take on that is don't try to be clever. The clever solution is never the right one. It's showing off and it's ego and it clouds the issue. So often it's entertaining to find a very clever solution, but then if you're going to make the best solution, you need to polish the cleverness out of it and make it honest, make it explicit, make it truthful, make it say exactly what you want it to say, not hide it behind obfuscated abstractions. And it can also mean, you know, name the variable what it is. You know, not I1 and I2. Name it what the value is so that when someone comes through reading this code cold, they know exactly what value you're checking.
Hmm. And one of the things that Bob Martin has mentioned in the past is that when we see really clean code, we know what it is, right? We see it, we can identify that. And a quality that it might have is that when I'm reading it, it's pretty much what I expected. Have you opened code like that? Have you seen code that you've opened it up, you've read it, and you've been able to read it, and you just thought, wow, yeah, I get it?
Yes, but that's the exception, not the rule, in my experience. I'm often surprised when someone took the time to make the code clear for my benefit rather than for their own. Yeah, I have this idea that when we're developing software, we're like Luke Skywalker when he's standing on his hands and he's got Yoda on his feet and he's levitating boulders. When we're writing the code, we understand everything about it. We hold all the variables and method names and their parameters and return types in our head. We're there. And we can write code that works that doesn't communicate any of that understanding, but it executes on the machine. The problem is that the value is in that understanding we have there while we're holding it everything. And as soon as we get distracted and go to the next assignment, you know, all the boulders fall to the floor and Yoda falls over, you know, and then the next guy has to come and levitate everything again if we didn't take the time to actually bake that understanding into the code. So be honest, to me, be truthful is about actually saying in the code all of those things, all of that understanding, actually expressing the story that the code tells.
So in making that assertion in terms of something a reader can understand instead of, you know, I equals 62.
That is exactly it.
Yeah,
and
okay.
And at the time you're writing the code, I equals 62 makes perfect sense to you. Right. But you're levitating the boulder right now. The next guy's going to have to do all that same work to get to the point where he can understand that, or you can save him the time and you can make yourself more valuable by baking that understanding into the code.
I'm levitating the boulder. That's great. I'm going to carry that forward. So have you played with any new tools that you think are addressing any of these issues, like DSLs, for example?
I'm not a huge fan of DSLs. I've not seen it work yet. Kevin Hazard has described to me a situation in the medical industry that he's worked in where a DSL actually was worth the effort to create and maintain. The problem I see right now, I haven't seen any tools for creating DSLs that were lightweight enough and dependable enough to make it worth the effort to create a DSL. Often, you know, they're talking about having end users define things, and oftentimes end users would prefer a UI in my experience. So I haven't bought in yet.
Okay. Leave it at that. Well, there's some other things too, right? Because what we're talking about sounds like maybe raising that level of abstraction up a little bit above the logical operators and conditionals that we're used to looking at in our code. There are other languages that do things differently, like Ruby. Have anything there that strikes a chord?
Sure. But and that's a great point because, yes, the language can make this easier, right? Ruby and I think Python as well both read naturally, very natural language-like. My background is in writing Visual Fox Pro, which is a very much like a business DSL. I mean, I've plenty of times had accountants and CFOs look over my shoulder at Foxpro code and be able to understand it. So it's certainly possible to have the language help you in this, but I've seen so much bad code in easy-to-read languages that I don't think that the tooling or the language is the solution. That's why I'm trying to introduce this metaphor so that we as developers, we love to think about low-level stuff. We love to think about things in terms of the machine, but then you have to translate machine into human. So if we can bring the language of the machine closer to the language of human by making our code more expressive, then everybody wins no matter what language you're in.
I opened some F-sharp code the other day because I've been trying to pick up F-sharp. It was being written by a college student, actually, this particular piece of code, somebody who is in a computer science program, and every variable was a one-letter name, and there was absolutely no description of what the functions they were declaring did, you know. Function A, function B, quite literally.
Right.
And rather than trying to invest, rather than making the investment that it would have taken for me to grok that code, I walked away from it. Mm-hmm. Simply because of what you're talking about. The investment was too high. Whereas if they had simply written a little bit more verbosely, you know, for somebody to understand, I would have stuck with it and I would have been invested more in the code itself.
Right, but and that's where, you know, these pressures we're under as far as time and all the other expectations on us get in our way. So as soon as we get the understanding on our head, we just express it in that first draft, and then we ship that, right? You know, once if you had written that code, it would make perfect sense to you when you checked it in. But and that would have, you know, gotten whatever pressures were waiting on you. You'd get the monkey off your back. And that would have been a relief. In writing, they have the same attitude of just get it down, but then they have the same idea of this idea of multiple drafts. And Annie Lamont actually says write shitty first drafts. That's like a mantra for her. Because if you have this idea that my first attempt is going to be really bad, then it's easier to make that first attempt and get whatever understanding you have down. But then she also talks about multiple drafts. The first draft is the child's draft. It's just where you get down whatever idea you have, you know, write it in the simplest, most embarrassing format. It's not for anyone else's consumption. The second draft, so the first draft is the down draft, right? The second draft is the up draft where you go back and you clean it up. That's where you were talking about taking out the stuff that you don't need, that doesn't help your cause. And then she says the third draft is the dental draft, where you do a careful inspection of every tooth and find, you know, any problems with it. And we really need more of a culture of that, that kind of multi-pass writing in software development. I think it's beneficial, and I think if people take on, if software developers that say are not interested or schooled in any XP or Lean or Agile or Scrum or any of these kind of catchphrases out there, if they just had this idea of themselves as a writer, then they would naturally adopt similar practices because they would be going for the same goals. The goal is, you know, maintainable code. The goal is getting the best value out of your time invested in creating this solution. And so this metaphor of writing these drafts, I think, is so very useful. And it just is totally overlooked in my experience. And that's why most of the code that I open looks like somebody's first draft. It looks like a child wrote it because it was the downdraft. They just got it down and then they got rid of it.
So, Alan, the metaphor's working for me. I understand the parallels you're drawing, but why do you think we've ended up here? Why do you think that we don't do this when it so clearly does work for us to take a couple of passes at our code? Are there, you know, reality-based reasons that people have that simply don't allow for us to do this?
I don't think we've given ourselves permission. I don't. Certainly, your experience with that F-sharp code from the college student is a clear example of that's not taught in the technical training, because the technical training is technical training. A lot of this is what I developed after about a five-year apprenticeship in software development. It was at that point that some of these ideas started to come together. And that's about the time I started to go talk to other people about software development, because I had to make these mistakes over time and realize, oh, the technical solution isn't the all in all of the value of this code, because I keep coming back and changing it. And I didn't allow for that later. I didn't allow for me or someone else to have to understand it. I didn't allow for the fact that this code is going to change in ways that I don't expect when I first implement the solution.
So, Alan, you're a very heavily involved community member and have a couple of things going on. What is it that you spend your time doing for the community?
Well, I like to go around and speak, and I'm tangentially involved in two really terrific events here in Tennessee that happen annually. I facilitate the open spaces at both of these events, and it's been really rewarding for me the last few years to be doing that. The first one is CodeStock, which is going to be in its third year here in 2010 in Knoxville, Tennessee. That one's occurring June 25th and 26th here in Knoxville, and you can find that event online at codestock.org. And the other is DevLink, which is John Keller's fantastic event in Nashville, Tennessee. And I've been involved with that since its first year and been doing the open spaces there the last few years. And DevLink this year is August 5th through the 7th. In Nashville, and you can find DevLink online at devlink.net.
Probably the only guy I know that can pull off a full velvet sport coat and make it work for you. I really appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Well, thanks, Alan, for sharing his ideas. Always a pleasure talking to him. We want the Pluralcast to be your favorite technical show, and we look forward to your participation to ensure that that actually happens. So please send us your feedback and suggestions, or tell us your own story at cast.pluralsight.com. Thanks also go to The Judies for letting us use their great music. Learn more about The Judies at wastedtalentrecords.com. Now that's all for this episode from Pluralcast World Headquarters. Join me next time, and we'll see what we can learn together on the Pluralcast. Modern world, let's move.
or more concrete, no protest is best. Don't be a hippie, 'cause only time will tell. Only time will tell. Only time will tell. Only time.